Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, the topic reminds me of an occasion, a recent occasion at our university. The dean of the college was retiring. He made a retirement speech, and with a tear in his eye and a jerk in his voice, he said, "Old deans never die. They just lose their faculties." This same man also tells a story of university president. He was a president at a great state university. He was a handsome man. He was accustomed to always saying yes, and consequently he was much loved. But the fortunes of the university declined, and the Board of Regents finally decided that the great difficulty with the university president was that he was, quite frankly, stupid. And to remedy the situation, it was suggested that the university hospital perform a brain transplant operation. And since the university president was accustomed to always saying yes, he agreed that it was a good idea, and the operation was performed. Alas, the president died. And in discussing it with the regents, the surgeon said, the surgeon was asked whether or not the body had rejected the brain. And the surgeon said, "No, the brain had rejected the body." There is a striking parallel between the crisis in government at the national level in America and the crisis in the universities. In both cases, the institutional structure has recently increased gigantically in size and in scale of operation. And along with this increase in size has gone a tremendous augmentation of power, both real and potential. However, it's a characteristic of this power that it is diffuse and focused only with difficulty, that it is all but impossible to bring this power effectively to bear on the problems of the state and of the university. The problems which bedevil both state and university are frequently not problems which can be solved, moreover, by the application of power. Along with the augmentation of size and power has gone a singular inability to match commitments with resources, so that the state and the universities, in spite of mega dollar budgets, find themselves perennially impoverished. And finally, and most importantly, each finds itself alienated from its constituency. Each has discovered that it is increasingly difficult for it to project an objective which will move men to its single-minded pursuit. It is not that men no longer believe in education or in government. Indeed, they believe passionately in both. It is, rather, that they no longer understand either the purposes are the designs of big government or big education. Even those who conform do so without enthusiasm and are reluctant to defend the institution from its enemies. While the power of both institutions has steadily increased, their authority has declined. Ultimately, authority is far more important to education than power. And power without authority in the state is tyranny. Now, the parallel between the state and the university, I think, is instructive. Both big government and big education face a crisis in confidence. And they face this crisis for basically the same reasons. They have done a good many things, a good many of the right things in the wrong way, and they have been doing a good many things which they should never have attempted, things for which they were totally unequipped. what is necessary in order to restore the institutional authority of higher education? How can higher education regain the confidence of those over 30 and command the respect of those under 30 who listen with reluctance and who dissent without debate? It would be false to assume that all our difficulties are institutional in origin, that they arise from the fact that the university has either done too much or done too little. It must be said at the very outset, and the fact has to be faced with candor and resolution, that the most important problem which higher education faces today is a growing wave of irrationality and anti-intellectualism which has caught up large numbers of both students and professors. Student and professor activists inside the university and certain ideological groups outside the university no longer believe that truth must be the essential consideration in the academy. Both the extreme right and the extreme left hold the same destructive view. Both Mark Rudd of Columbia and Governor Wallace of Alabama stand in the schoolhouse door. And seen from the vantage point of the academy, they both hold the same low view of reasoned discourse. They believe that force ought to be substituted for sweet reason, that power ought to replace persuasion, and that only socially approved voices and views should be heard. They believe that toleration is a weakness rather than a strength of intellectual inquiry, and they are, in the deepest sense of the word, anti-intellectual. They aim at nothing less than the destruction of the life of reason. The university and the parent society have no alternative to repression. These groups cannot be permitted to disrupt and to destroy the institutions they so obviously do not understand. They constitute a small minority, and it is possible that had university administrators not been long accustomed by their faculties to bearing fools gladly, these groups would already have disappeared from the campus scene. But their disappearance will not restore the authority of the university, and this, I think, we must underscore. When this wave of activism is over, the university's authority will still stand impaired. If the institutional aspirations of education are once more to become credible, universities must regain a sense of modesty and selectivity in the formulation of their objectives. They cannot be all things to all men. The notion of the multiversity is rejected with justice by students and by professors alike. There are perceptive members of the faculty who find the idea of the multiversity an abomination. They reject it not simply because it is impossible to administer, but because it represents institutional goallessness. It does not know its own mind. The able administrator in the setting of the multiversity is not a man characterized by unusual educational vision, but he is usually someone whose social acoustical equipment is highly refined and who acutely senses all the many needs of his society. He is committed to servicing those needs and adjusting and compromising between these many conflicting interests. Modesty is unknown or is swept aside by megalomania or mediocrity, or both in combination. Little wonder that in such circumstances the teacher feels he's an unwanted encumbrance and the student senses that he's a forgotten man. To compound the problem, now by expecting the university to become a kind of court of last resort for the solution of the major social problems of our time will only deepen the crisis that the university faces. Now, until then, there is a restoration of genuine educational purpose. There will be no restoration of confidence by society, either in its institutions of higher education or in its colleges and technical institutes. That educational purpose does not lie in the first place in pure or applied research, in problem solving, or in providing revolutionary change, or in defending traditional values in the society, though all of these may result from the legitimate endeavors of higher education. Higher education has as its chief goal the education of young men and women in such a way as to make them capable participants in our complicated technological civilization, sophisticated and creative members of our common culture, and active and concerned citizens. In order to ensure the circumstances in which teaching, rather than research, or community service are the primary objectives of the university, government at all levels must forego the temptation of easy recourse to the enormous resources of the university. Recently, there's been a great deal of debate concerning the use of the talent and facilities available in the university for defense research. It is not, I think, inconsistent to argue that under very exceptional circumstances, the university ought freely to use its talent in the defense of the society, and still to maintain that both the government and the university would be better served under most circumstances were both basic and applied research in the national defense area done in autonomous research institutes. The same case can be made against the use of the facilities of the university for the solution of social problems. Social tasks are better performed by institutions and facilities out. And applied research. Much of the debate concerning university research at the present misses the point. War research is no more illicit or licit than peace research, nor is the test of the validity of research within the university context whether or not it has direct relevance to social and political problems or to the technical needs of the moment. The only sound test is whether or not research enhances or diminishes the primary teaching function of the university. And it must be confessed that in spite of the brave talk to the contrary and considerable administrative legerdemain, research has become the tail which wags the dog. Faculty members on fractional appointments who spend the greater part of their time in other than teaching activities distort and confuse the educational processes of the university. Foundation grants for centers and programs, which are often inconsistent with the needs and basic educational directions of the institution, are as dangerous to the university as government. Civic and business research for which there is no clear-cut teaching mandate. The university cannot be all things to all men. There is a difference between being alma mater to generation after generation of students and being the not-so-well-paid kept woman who does the bidding of the most recent and persuasive suitor. Where there is no vision, one could say it either way, the people perish, is an observation which is as true of institutions as it is of nations. In education, however, our pressing need is not for a single and unitary vision, but rather for visions as different and as diverse as the pluralism of our society. education cannot be genuinely relevant to our society and to its needs unless it is diverse, both in objective and in technique. The possibility for educational diversity in America is enormous. It's simply immense. But in reality, American education is homogeneous and uniform. The privately endowed colleges do poorly what the state universities do only a little better. And a handful of determinative major universities, as alike as peas in a pod, set the tone and the direction for the whole educational enterprise. American education has become a single mechanism, its professors and students interchangeable parts. Under these circumstances, even student riots are monotonously, repellently alike. Among the most important functions of education is that of widening the options available to men in the solution of their problems and in the improvement of the quality of their lives. Yet our universities steadily diminish and dilute the differences between themselves. Students are still able to choose the quality of their education. They are unable, however, to do much through their own choices about the kind of education they receive. It is important that we reestablish a free market in education. It is important that the church-related school survive, not as a secularized ghost of its former self, but as a school with a genuinely religious vision of the world, a school in which men learn to serve God and their fellow men rather than themselves. It is important that private humanistic colleges, with their commitment to civilization and decorum and their quiet emphasis on freedom, remain an important constituent of the American system. It is essential that we have genuine experimentation in curriculum and method, and not the pseudo-experiments hatched by administrators and departmental chairmen who need an excuse for hitting the foundations or the legislators once again for funds. I could list a dozen examples of the kinds of pseudo-experiments which are hatched by departmental chairmen and university administrators with the intention of raising funds from a foundation. We cannot have this diversity, however, until the federal and the state governments drastically alter the role they play in financing higher education. American education will become diverse and relevant to the needs of both the student and the nation when, and only when, the student is forced to pay a very substantial portion of the total costs of his education. Privilege without responsibility is a very dangerous condition. Privilege without either responsibility or choice generates unbearable tensions in the society which makes such privileges possible. State schools, which compete unfairly with private schools through discriminatory tuition rates, have been the chief force in leveling and homogenizing American education. Indiscriminate federal grants on the basis of administrative judgment rather than student choice have only reinforced this movement toward uniformity. If we genuinely desire diversity, we will do all in our power to encourage students to pay for their education through a tax upon future earnings or through a loan program of some sort. If we genuinely wish diversity, we will insist that such educational grants as are made by the federal government will be made directly to the student rather than to the institution in which the student studies. Only when there is a free market in education, with a student and his parents able to choose among schools diverse in kind and quality, will we be able honestly to say to students, we don't pretend to supply the sort of education you wish or need. If you really want a totally unstructured, ungraded course of study, segregated, revolutionary, socially relevant,
you can get it, or let's say at Columbia, or Brandeis, or Rutgers, but you can't get it here. The growing sense of alienation among students arises in substantial measure from their inability to choose the quality and kind of education they believe relevant to their lives. Well, not only should there be a diversification in the kind of college and university training available, but diversification should bring into existence a wide range of educational alternatives, apprenticeship programs, proprietary schools, technical institutes operated by industry with the direct training of specifically needed talents in mind, strengthening and broadening of the junior and community college programs are all of considerable importance in the problem of making education relevant to the needs of the student and to the needs of society. The American public must be disabused of the notion that the AB degree holds some sort of magic. For some time, it's not been a mark of status, and certainly is not a guaranteed pass to higher income. The right of entry into a craft union is often more difficult to achieve than entry into the most exclusive college. It strikes me as odd that the new left, which has been so concerned with the indiscriminate admission of all minority group students into colleges, irrespective of their qualifications, has had little or nothing to say of the restrictive practices which deny the right of entry of many of these same minority groups into those favored unions which possess monopoly advantages in our economy and in our society. Someone should say clearly that the way to status and achievement in our society is not through learning Swahili, but through learning English. Someone needs to say clearly that the way to affluence does not lie through an AB degree granted by yesterday's second-rate normal college, but by a marketable skill which will secure for its holder and his family the dignity of achievement. Nearly every professor has in the past several years encountered in what he thought a rather sober discussion of an academic question, a sudden denunciation by a student member of the audience. The student doesn't challenge the professor's method or even question his data, but simply rejects his position as being immoral or fascist or racist or as simply irrelevant. There's no debate or discussion, no attempt to identify the question or purposefully expose the issue. It is assumed that absolute right prevails on one side and that moral obtuseness, Marxian false consciousness, or plain wrongdoing characterizes the other side. The issue is not joined. It is not even discussed. Question periods at lectures are not occasions for refining the position of the lecturer. They are seen as opportunities to present long, rambling denunciations and counter-lectures. The student usually ends his harangue with a plea for relevance, and the lecturer, if he's smart enough, gathers that the young man or the young lady, it's sometimes difficult to tell just which it is alienated. Last fall, the London Times reported an international meeting of philosophers in Vienna in the following words. This is a quote from the Times. While their elders and betters solemnly discussed the epistemological significance of the phrases, Johnny has lost his pen, I have found a pen, I know Johnny lost it. The students are racing through the corridors, shouting, what about the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia? Burning Russian and American flags, and wrestling with their professors for microphones during the debates. It is disgusting, say the students, that 3,000 of the wisest men from every country in the world should have gathered together in the largest philosophical talk in history and have nothing forceful to say about the Russian tanks on the Czech border only 50 miles away. If philosophy has any real function, it should be performing it now. And here the quotation ends. Well, clearly what the student seeks is a relevant orthodoxy rather than an agonizing inquiry. Faced with some of the toughest choices in history, and living in a period when traditional certainties and traditional values have been challenged and opposed by alternatives, the student is really calling upon his professor for a clear and definitive answer, and one preferably couched in currently fashionable vocabulary and bearing the marks of current social concern. To the student, education is irrelevant if it cannot provide a solution. Preferably, of course, a solution which costs the student nothing and whose weight is borne by the non-student sectors of the society. The student wants to know what to think rather than how to think. And the student has far too many professors who are willing to tell him what to think rather than attempt to teach him how to think for himself. The student has learned his lessons only too well. His professors, especially in the humanities and the social sciences, have all too often been exponents of an established orthodoxy rather than masters in the art of reasoned inquiry. The situation is not to be mended by diversifying orthodoxies. And here I want to get back to the questions raised this morning. That's the student's solution. He wishes to replace the liberal orthodoxy with a new left orthodoxy, a WASP orthodoxy with a black orthodoxy, a permissive and tolerant orthodoxy with a repressive orthodoxy. What the student wishes is a substitution of orthodoxies rather than an end to all closed systems. His effort will only compound the problem, for the liberal ascendancy in today's colleges and universities is like the pre-1918 Austrian Empire. It's an autocracy ameliorated by inefficiency. While the students' Maoist dictatorships would end altogether the life of reason. The professor, if he is to reestablish the authority of reason, must not only admit to the possibility of his being wrong, but he must have the openness of mind necessary to, as Lord Acton said, make out the best possible case for error. He must actively court diversity and contradiction rather than seek the world of like-minded men. He must continuously engage in a great debate, not only with his students and his colleagues, but above all with himself. And as President Truman said, if he can't stand the heat, he should get out of the kitchen. The ideological and cultural uniformity of higher education in America is a disgrace. Why is it that our colleges and universities have conformed themselves over the past two decades to the orthodoxy of secular liberalism? Why has the atmosphere been so increasingly hostile to open debate? Why does it take the crisis of the exclusion of the Negro from the university to make us see that not only people, but ideas have been excluded by higher education? The authority and the relevance of the university lie in its ability as an institution to explore systematically and rationally the problems which face men. Its success is not dependent upon current fashions. Current fashions and ideas are current solutions to particular problems. Its success derives from its ability to take the long view and to ask the hard question. And the hardest of these is the question the professor asks of himself, of his colleagues, and of his society about the possibility of being wrong. Thank you.